Ladies and gentlemen, it is 2015. I would like us to reconvene, please. So, thank you. Mr. Harris, would you please introduce our next item 12?
Item 12 is an overview of groundwater legislation and regulations by the State Water Resources Control Board Groundwater Program Manager. We're pleased to have Eric Ekdahl from the State Water Board here today. He is leading the State Water Board's implementation of the new Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, and he is going to give us an overview of the groundwater legislation and regulations. Eric gave a presentation to the last MCC, and I thought it was very informative, and I know you all have lots of questions, so I asked Eric to come down. I thought it would it's very timely, and I thought you all would benefit greatly from his presentation. So I'll turn it over to Eric.
Great. Can you hear me, everyone? Okay. And there is a PowerPoint. Is it on?
You also have that in your folders.
There we go. Great. Thank you for the introduction. I'm Eric Ekdahl. I'm here joined with two of my staff members, Tom Peltier and Jessica Bean. They're both engineering geologists, and Jessica will actually give part of the presentation in a few minutes. I'm here to give a brief overview of the State Water Board's role in the new Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. I'll touch on five separate subjects. I'll give a brief overview or background of what got us to the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, or SGMA, as it's also being referred to, if you haven't heard the acronym pronounced that way already. I'll also do a brief SGMA overview, what's in the legislation, what does it require. I'll talk about how the Water Board and the Department of Water Resources are coordinating their activities and implementation efforts. Then Jessica will give a brief overview of what SGMA looks like in Region 3, where are there basins that are higher medium priority and basins that are in critical overdraft, and then I'll finish up with a brief overview of other program work, other things that are going on related to groundwater management at the state level. So some of you, I'm guessing actually most of you, have seen these figures before, and I'll go through this kind of quickly, but I like to start with a general overview of what brought us to SGMA. I'll talk about three drivers: a natural driver, things like climate, precipitation. I'll talk about a state driver, things that have happened at the state level that have driven us towards a need for integrated groundwater management. And I'll also talk about decisions at the local level that have helped or exacerbated local groundwater conditions. I'll start with this natural driver figure. This is a figure from February of 2014 versus 2015. We've all seen these figures, the greatly diminished snowpack along the Sierras, an incredibly warm winter in 2015. Basically, you know, there's a natural driver that there's simply less water available. This is the fourth year of drought. The snowpack this year was at 5%, although if you can see, 2014 was brown, 2015 was green. We actually did get more rain in 2015, but due to the incredibly warm nature of the winter, some areas are referring to the last 2 years as the years without winter. Stations in the Sierra averaging 10 to 15 degrees above long-term average, there really was no snowpack, less than 5% of long-term average. At the same time, there have been state drivers. So this graph shows California population along this axis in millions, and we start at 1900, go to 2012. Our population has increased dramatically over the last 60 years or so. Here's 1960. Our water infrastructure hasn't kept pace with that development. So if you look at when our major state and federally funded projects were built and completed, Shasta Dam was a population of about 8 million people. The Delta Mendota, about 12 million. The California Aqueduct, less than 20 million. And the last major state project, Oroville Dam completed in 1971, I believe. Our population was about 20 million people. There have been other local projects, so New Malones was 1978, I believe, and there have been local groundwater storage projects that have occurred in this section. Today, our population is about 39 million. Our 2020 estimate is somewhere between 42 and 47, although it's probably going to be on the lower end of that range. Long story short, there's a lot more people in California. There's a lot more demand on those water resources that we have, and the amount of those water resources hasn't changed. It's been relatively static. At the same time, there have been local drivers. So this is a figure from the SBX 2-1 nitrate report completed by UC Davis in 2013. It shows land use and crop type or crop patterns in 1946. The takeaway, large sections of the Central Valley were really native vegetation. That's this pale green color. A large portions of the Salinas Valley were, if you look, that's really grain, rice, and hay. So a lot of it was really, you know, forage crop for animals. You can see historic patterns that have been there for a long time. You know, there's always been a lot of grapes around Fresno. You can already see a nascent citrus belt developing along the east side of the San Joaquin. If you jump forward to 2010, you can see there have been huge changes at local land use patterns. So a hardening of crop types. This has largely been replaced by vegetables, nursery, and berry crops down here with a significant increase in vineyards as well. In the Central Valley, you see the arrival of deciduous fruits and nuts. These things require continuous water. You can't fallow them year to year depending on water availability. So these three factors, climate or natural drivers, local population increases, water infrastructure, and local land use, have forced a greater and greater reliance on groundwater that through time has put more and more pressure on the resource. Throughout that time, there's been relatively little management of it, of that resource at the state level, resulting in plummets in groundwater level. This is a report from the Department of Water Resources that came out in, I believe, fall of 2014, showing, it's a little bit blurry here, that parts of the Central Valley have seen a water decline of more than 60 feet, and this is in a single year. Eventually, that brought the recognition that there needed to be long-term planning and resource management for groundwater in California. And so in 2014, a series of bills were passed, AB 1739, SB 1168, and SB 1319. They were passed by the legislature in August and signed by the governor in September 2014. These package of bills are collectively known as the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, or SGMA. These bills provide a new framework for managing groundwater at the local level, but also provide a background or framework where the state can intervene, a state backstop to help essentially motivate locals to manage their own resources. And one of the central tenets included in the signing statement by the governor was that, you know, these bills recognize that groundwater management is best accomplished locally, that groundwater really does reflect local conditions, and so locals are going to be the best situated to handle their own local groundwater needs. Moving on, what does SGMA entail? Well, the basics, it requires development of local sustainability agencies, groundwater sustainability agencies. They're sometimes abbreviated as GSAs. Those sustainability agencies must develop groundwater sustainability plans. Those are required in 127 high and medium priority basins, and I'll show a map of this in a second. Those plans and the local management agencies are now authorized, are provided new management tools to help directly manage a groundwater resource. These include management tools including fees, new fee authorities, they can require well spacing requirements. They cannot or do not include well permitting authority. That retains or remains with the county. SGMA defines a framework or a time frame for accomplishing goals. It also provides an alternative if users can show that a basin has been historically managed sustainably. It also creates the state backstop. This is what the state of SGMA looks like. SGMA applies in these high and medium priority basins in the red and yellow. The priorities were developed using the Department of Water Resources CASGEM, or California Statewide Groundwater Elevation Monitoring Program Prioritization Scheme. That calculation included population growth, irrigated acreage, public supply well distribution, and a couple of other variables. They used a series of essentially metrics to come up with a scoring mechanism and classified all 515 groundwater basins in the state into one of these four priorities. SGMA only applies in the high and medium priority basins. There are several key SGMA requirements. First, groundwater sustainability agencies must be formed in those high and medium priority basins by 2017. They can be comprised of one or more local public agency. If there is more than one local public agency per basin, SGMA requires that those agencies must come up with a coordination agreement in developing their future sustainability plans. Those sustainability plans are required in 2020 if you're a basin in critical overdraft, or in 2022 for all of the other high and medium priority basins. There are 18 basins that the Department of Water Resources has defined as in critical overdraft, and Jessica will point out a couple in Region 3 in a couple of minutes. Those sustainability plans require measurable objectives, implementation milestones, and have significant annual reporting requirements, including water use, extraction, and change in storage that must be submitted to the Department of Water Resources. In addition, SGMA requires that these basins achieve sustainability 20 years or within 20 years after plan adoption, and that those plans prevent what's called undesirable results. Fortunately, SGMA also defines sustainability and undesirable results. And sustainability in the Water Code is defined as management and use of groundwater in a manner that can be maintained during the planning and implementation horizon without causing undesirable results, where undesirable results are specifically defined as either one, the chronic lowering of groundwater levels, not including overdraft during a drought if the basin is otherwise managed. Undesirable results can also include reductions in groundwater storage, seawater intrusion, degradation of water quality, significant and unreasonable land subsidence, and surface water depletions that adversely impact beneficial uses. If those undesirable results occur, if sustainability is not achieved, SGMA then allows the state board to step in as the state backstop. A few basics as we start talking about what the big backstop actually means and what the board will be doing in implementation of the backstop. In every circumstance, the state board can only step in when local efforts do not succeed. So there's no mechanism where the board can arbitrarily decide to step in and start directly managing a basin through SGMA. Second, the timing and the role of the state board intervention depends on how those locals do not succeed. And I'll go through these in a couple of slides. Lastly, it's also important to point out that there are numerous off-ramps for locals to avoid management by the state. So even if the board starts implementing portions of the backstop, if local efforts come up to speed, then the board is required to step back and let those local efforts proceed. These are the four intervention triggers allowed under SGMA for the State Water Board. The first occurs in June 30th, 2017. For areas that fail to form a groundwater sustainability agency. The State Water Board can begin what's called the probationary basin designation process 180 days after this date, so really June or January 2018. Our second intervention trigger occurs in 2020 when a probationary basin designation can occur in critically overdrafted basins that fail to form a sustainability plan, or where the Department of Water Resources makes the determination that that sustainability plan is inadequate. That same trigger also occurs in 2022 for those other high and medium priority basins that aren't in critical overdraft. And then lastly, there's another opportunity for the State Board to intervene where the Department of Water Resources finds that a sustainability plan is inadequate or is not being implemented correctly, and the State Water Board also finds that there is significant depletion of interconnected surface water. Again, the important takeaway point is that in all triggering events, the intervention is the result of failure by locals to either create a sustainability agency, to create a sustainability plan, or to actually implement that plan in a way that will result in sustainability. What are the future Water Board roles in implementing the backstop? I like to talk about, and this is a little more conceptual, this isn't spelled out in the Water Code, but what are we going to be doing over the next couple of years? It's still a couple of years before that 2017 date, and even farther until 2020 and 2022. We really have two primary roles within SGMA. One is as a data manager, so collecting data, looking at it, interpreting it, and figuring out if a basin is in overdraft or if it's having effects on surface water beneficial uses. Our second role is looking, once we look at that data, taking it a step further and saying we're going to develop a plan that directly manages groundwater at the local level until your local efforts come up to speed. Third, SGMA roles for both the Department of Water Resources and the State Water Board are very intimately connected. And so a lot of the work that we're going to be doing for the next couple of years really focuses on communication, outreach, regulation development, and implementation of the backstop, coordinating that with the DWR and communicating that with local efforts that are going on to kind of create those sustainability agencies and those sustainability plans. Our first role in July 1st, 2017 is for those areas that don't form a GSA. And we've been referring to those as potentially unmanaged areas or PUMAs. You may have also heard those referred to as white spot areas. It's essentially the same thing, those areas that don't form a GSA. The Water Code requires users in PUMAs to start reporting specific groundwater extraction information to the State Water Board. That information includes place of extraction, so the well location, monthly records of volume of extractions, the purpose of use, what they're using that water for, the place of use, and significantly, if we take this further and we start designating a probationary basin, we can actually ask for more information than what is specifically listed in the Water Code. Anything that we would need to help designate a probationary basin and write an interim management plan. We're going to spend the next couple of years focusing on development of that reporting system. We need it to be electronic. We don't know exactly how many PUMAs we're going to have, but if we look, we've done some data mining of the Department of Water Resources well log database and have come up with some rough estimates of well densities that could be subject to SGMA. And in some places, you know, we're talking about over 500 wells per township. If we start having a significant number of PUMAs that start reporting to the board, we need it to be an electronic reporting system because there's not enough staff to essentially manage that if those were coming in by paper records. We also need to develop the system to manage the data for development of interim plans. We'll use it to track fees. There will be fees associated with PUMAs. There will be some sort of public interface as well. Very briefly, you know, it's 2015 now. This has to be up and functioning by July 1st, 2017. We'll likely hold stakeholder outreach beginning in winter of 2016 with a version hopefully up and running by January 2017 that we can use for beta testing. Once we go beyond that role as a data manager and we can start directly working with the basin itself, we have a couple of different steps. First, we need to develop fees to support basin management. Once we do that, we need to designate probationary basins, either because they didn't form a GSA, they didn't write their plan, or because the department has referred that plan to us. A probationary basin designation will lead to development of interim sustainability plans, which we will use to manage a basin until local efforts come up to speed. I'll go through this one quickly. Our fees, we are required by the Water Code to recover costs related to the backstop. That can include facilitation, investigation, monitoring, hearings, enforcement, and administration. We're also required to collect fees to cover the PUMA reporting database. That fee system needs to be in place with the data reporting system, so by July 1st, 2017, we'll adopt those by emergency regulation in late spring of that year. As we mentioned earlier, there are a number of key activities by the Department of Water Resources that we've been working closely with them in messaging and communication. One of the first DWR activities is revising or creating regulations that can allow locals to request basin boundary revisions. They are also required to identify basins in critical overdraft. The last time that DWR did this was 1980, and so they're going to update that list because it does factor into the time frame of when those sustainability plans are required. They're going to update basin priorities probably in 2017 and likely again in 2020. SGMA requires, if you remember that slide that showed the CASGEM prioritization scheme, SGMA added a new one that is essentially looking at ecosystems and effect of groundwater on ecosystems. And so DWR needs to go back, factor that into their CASGEM prioritization. And there's the likelihood that some basins that had historically been categorized as low or very low will get moved up into high or medium. I put this in green because I think this is the most significant role that DWR has in a host of significant roles over the next couple of years. DWR is required to develop regulations that describe essentially what needs to go into a sustainability plan and describes how those sustainability plans will be reviewed. And that's really a key process for the board because, in essence, DWR is writing the regulations that the board will later on enforce. It's kind of an unusual circumstance. You know, most other states, the regulation development and the enforcement would be under one agency. California has done things a little bit differently, so now we're separated. We need to coordinate closely with them and figure out how they're going to develop these plans, what they're going to require. We need to make sure that what they do require is feasible using the board's existing authorities under SGMA or other water code sections. And additionally, they're doing significant communication and outreach, and then they will develop Proposition 1 grant guidelines and funding criteria. Proposition 1 provided $100 million for groundwater sustainability plan development. There may be some of that money released beginning in the next fiscal year. I know that DWR is starting the grant guideline development process, and they'll likely have draft versions out, I believe, in late fall of 2015. We're coordinating with DWR on all of those factors, but in addition, we're kind of working on developing a set of teams that can help address specific issues. Right now we have four teams working together. We have a regulation development team, we have a data management team, a communication team, and then an overarching planning and management team. As we mentioned earlier, the Water Resources is responsible for evaluating and accepting sustainability plans, whereas the board is responsible for implementing the backstop, identifying probationary basins, and writing interim plan or management plans, and we need to figure out how we're going to do this together. Additionally, the board can request that DWR conduct investigations and provide additional technical assistance where necessary. And as we mentioned earlier, in some cases the board cannot designate a probationary basin without first consulting with DWR. Essentially, DWR can have first crack. They get first chance at designating whether a plan has succeeded or failed before they refer that to us for further backstop activities. Now at this point, I'm going to turn over the presentation to Jessica Bean. She's an engineering geologist in the groundwater management unit, although as of the last couple of months, I've lost her to some of the conservation work. So she has really taken a lead role in addressing conservation regulations that came out in May 5th, and handling a lot of the communication and outreach and question and answer duties associated with that. Someday I'm gonna get her full time back in the groundwater unit. But we'll switch spots and she'll talk about Region 3 specifically.
Okay, I'm gonna give you kind of a quick overview just to touch on some of the areas in Region 3 that we thought might be of interest. I wanna talk to you about the basin priorities and the idea of critical overdraft, and then talk about the complexity of management with a couple of examples. So if we look specifically at Region 3, what we've displayed here are, there are 60 basins here. 36 are very low, 15 are medium, and 9 are high. And as Eric mentioned, DWR is going to be reprioritizing in 2017 and possibly 2020. And some of those very low basins could possibly come up into higher medium. And we are planning to connect with the regional boards to help identify some of the issues in those very low basins so that we can work with DWR and let them know what those issues are, and you would know them best. So we will be outreaching to you soon. Want to focus on some basins of interest. These are, again, the high and medium priority basins are in orange and yellow. You have two basins in Region 3, the Pajaro Valley and the Cuyama Valley basins, which are considered in critical overdraft. Again, this was determined in 1980, so it's been a while, and some of the critically overdrafted basins are medium priority, so you'll notice that there's a medium and a high. I'm going to focus on Pajaro in a moment. And then I want to point out Los Osos because of the adjudication. Both the critical overdraft and the adjudication add some different levels of management complexity, and that's primarily what I'm going to speak to here, the different elements of complexity. So if we take a look at Pajaro specifically, it's a high-priority basin. It is in critical overdraft. There is storage depletion, and seawater intrusion is an issue. But what you can notice here is the counties are outlined. So you have three different counties are going to have to work together, potentially. And then there are about 15 water systems. So that's a pretty complex area. If we take a look here, the Pajaro Valley Water Management Agency is the special act district for the area. And SGMA specifically designates them as the GSA for the area. But you'll note that the agency does not actually cover the entire basin boundary as designated by Bulletin 118. So even though the PVWMA is the agency, they're going to have to work with other agencies. The counties, the cities, municipalities, and other stakeholders to manage the basin. To make it even more complex, this particular basin is bordered by four other higher medium priority basins, and there's about at least 20 wells per square mile, so there's a lot going on here. And basically what I would like to point out in terms of complexity is that there's going to have to be agreements between agencies both within the basin and then between the agencies in the basin and with surrounding basins. So this is a pretty complex area that's going to require a lot of management with various entities. And some of that is specified in SGMA, where you have the coordination is required, and then some of it's just for hydrologic purposes going to have to happen. The next one I wanted to look, here we go. Here are the higher medium priority basins, bring those up for you. So you can see it just keeps getting more and more complex when you're looking at the different stakeholders. And again, SGMA requires that the GSA take into consideration all water users in the basin. So if we then take a look at the Los Osos area, the first thing that I wanted to point out here is SGMA specifically exempts the Los Osos adjudication when it's complete from the act, but it's unclear right now if that applies to anyone within that boundary that is not subject to the adjudication. So we are not entirely clear on how that's going to work right now. But what we do know is that the adjudication does not align with the groundwater basin itself. And so the areas outside of the adjudication are going to be subject to the requirements. This is a high priority basin.
May I ask a question? Sorry to interrupt.
Sure.
You said that, and this has been a question that I've raised a number of times, and I realize it's an ongoing process of evaluating. But if the adjudication involves certain parties, and then as the SGMA comes into play and these deadlines come forward, would the interlocutory group that's adjudicating their portion of the basin, would they be required then to participate with those outside the boundaries of the adjudicated area so that in a roundabout way, they actually will come into compliance with SGMA?
There is nothing in the legislation that specifies that they would have to do that. There are options that they have. They could certainly look to expanding the adjudication boundary to incorporate those areas if they decided to do that. Unfortunately, what it looks like is that the areas outside of the basin, because they are not exempt, but they are in that high priority status, they're going to have to work with the adjudication because it's required to manage the basin as a whole. So it is a kind of a difficult situation and a little unclear right now, again, because of the issue with the pumpers who are not considered in the adjudication. Did you want to? No, is that okay?
No,
okay.
That's the very issue that I'm concerned with.
Yeah, so, and that's what we've been looking at in terms of management options were just that. As we've evaluated it, it seems that the adjudication could extend its boundary and incorporate all of that if that was made. The two areas that you see here could certainly either collectively form a GSA or they could each form GSAs, and they could then would need to work for data collection and things of that nature to figure things out. If that doesn't happen, if neither of those happen, the county could certainly come in and take those over. And then the last option would be if no one wants to take over, then the management would trigger the state intervention, and so that reporting would begin to the state board. So it is very complex. But certainly, if the group that is handling that, if they wanted to outreach and if the court wanted to extend the boundary, they could do that. How that's going to comply with SGMA, though, that would bring them into the adjudication, not bring the adjudication back out into the requirements of the legislation. It is a little complicated, clearly.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the last thing, because that just led perfectly into what I was going to tell you about, the last thing to point out is that the adjudicated area does have to begin reporting to DWR. So they do have requirements. They have to submit reports. And then those areas outside will have to form a GSA by 2017. And because it's a high priority basin but not currently in critical overdraft, they will have to have their plans by 2022, which means they would need to be sustainable by 2042, just to give you an idea on that. So I'll pass it back over to Eric. Okay. That's everything I have.
So very quickly, we'll finish up. The unit has been working on a couple of other areas. There is cleanup legislation. I believe there's one bill at present, SB 13, that just really addresses a couple of dates in SGMA that need to align a little bit better. At the same time, there's also 10 other groundwater-related bills. We're working with our legislative council when we're requested. We're not sure whether those will go through or not, but there's a lot of activity on groundwater at the present. We've also been looking at groundwater recharge as a beneficial use, and this is a particularly hot topic in certain parts of the state, particularly the Central Valley. Right now, groundwater recharge on its own is not a beneficial use. You have to put that water to use later on. There's been some activity to try and classify it as a beneficial use, but in doing that, it kind of leads to other problems. It could lead to a water grab, and really right now, there's nothing that prevents people from using groundwater to recharge a basin, so long as they can demonstrate that it's actually being used later on and they're not just kind of using it as a way to grab surface water rights. There's also two bills on adjudication reform. One is sponsored by the Farm Bureau, one is sponsored by Senator Pavley. There may be a third bill, and it kind of remains to be seen what will happen in the future. The purposes of those bills right now are to kind of streamline the process and make it go a little more quickly. So the two treat SGMA differently, and we'll kind of have to see how those play out over the near-term future. In summary and in closing, what do we want to do over the next couple of years? Well, we want to focus on existing authorities. We do have some existing authorities on groundwater. There's waste and unreasonable use. There's a public trust doctrine, Water Code Section 2100, which does allow the Water Board to step in and adjudicate a basin when there is a known water quality issue. And we also have some authority over subterranean streams, although those are really applied only in a kind of a relatively narrow legal and geologic scenarios. We want to support water resources in the early years. If you remember those bulleted lists with that green item right in the middle, all of those items are required by DWR by 2017. They have a huge workload. And if you look at what we're required to do by 2017, we have to come up with a data system and develop fees. So our workload relative to DWR's, at least initially, is kind of balanced in their end. So we're working with them. That's part of this coordination effort and kind of seeing how we can support them in what they're doing. We also want to support areas that want our help. In some cases, the State Board can be very useful, whether we're appearing as that 800-pound gorilla in the other room and kind of looming over them as the backstop entity. But we don't want to just scare people. We want to also provide technical assistance. We do have significant financial authority or financial resources at our disposal, whether it's through Prop 1, the wastewater funding, the low-interest loans through the two revolving funds. There's a lot of things that are going to tie in together in the future. Developing a recycled water facility can reduce groundwater load. So looking at how we can provide financial resources is going to be really key, especially as these sustainability plans start to develop. We want to know the field and we want to be prepared to step in strategically. So we don't want to step in where we're not needed. If local efforts are actually going on, we want to work with them, not in opposition to them. We want to be able to know what the need is for intervention and be able to use that those tools sparingly and strategically. So we want to be judicious, strategic, and effective when acting. We want to have the lightest touch possible with the goal of local success. And we've said in some settings, the greatest success we can have is if the board never implements the backstop. And I think that's the goal that we're going to try and work for over the next couple of years. It's ambitious, and I think realistically there will be places where we have to implement the backstop. But we want to make the tools, the assistance, and kind of the background work necessary so that we can help locals succeed on their own terms before state board intervention. And with that, I'll say thank you. I also want to introduce Tom Peltier. He's in the back. He's the Region 3 liaison, so we've designated regional board liaisons within the unit. Jessica's also here, but because she's also being taken by conservation, point out Tom specifically. They're both great, and they're available to answer questions or any concerns. And with that, I'll answer any questions that you guys have.
Well, thank you for a very comprehensive presentation. Let's see, a couple of items. Go back to the previous slide. Okay. Focus on existing authorities. I thought that anti-dig was, although not often used, but still pretty well established as a legal authority.
So I'm trying to think of how to answer that question. NIDIG can be a very powerful tool, but if I remember my waste discharge requirement permits from a couple years ago, the last time I've really taken a look at them, they can be used very precisely, and they can also not be. And I know there's an effort underway at the state board level to revise the anti-degradation policy. Trying to figure out how anti-degradation factors into SGMA is a interesting question. The sustainability plans are required under SGMA to address water quality, but they're not required to address water quality that occurred prior to 2015. They have to look forward, but they don't have to look back. At the same time, the idea was that SGMA was a water quantity tool, and it wasn't necessarily written to address water quality. So we need to work with our own Division of Water Quality as they start to revise that anti-degradation policy and figure out how SGMA is going to play a role in that work. It can be used, though, when there is a clear case of water quality impacts. It's unclear how that will tie into water quantity.
Yeah, there is a direct link between quantity and quality.
Yes.
So that's why, I asked the question. And then my last question is that a lot of the data points that were used by DWR to establish high, medium priority basins and low priority goes back 35 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, you do some statistical analysis in growth, population growth, irrigated land, et cetera. But mm-hmm. here we are, 35 years later, and have certainly weather changes that have taken place. So next step, DWR revisits again the basins, and perhaps I didn't hear you, but what's the date when?
They'll likely start that process in the near future with a goal of having an interim update in 2017.
Okay, that's what I recall. So now comes 2017, and most likely there's going to be some changes in the categories.
Correct.
How do those new timelines come in? Because right now the timeline is, all right, as of 2015, we'll give you 2 years, and we're identifying specifically the basins that are going to have to address those issues.
Right.
Correct? So is what's going to be the next mechanism in 2017? Is that, you know,
basically, Sigma allows 5 years. So if you are a basin that moves from low or very low to medium or high, you're given 5 years to develop a sustainability plan. And whether that occur, you know, that change occurs in 2017 or 2020 or some point in the future, you'd still have 5 years from that time of change.
Or
from
meaning 5 years from 2017? Or
correct.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate very much your comprehensive presentation. And now I'll start this time on my right.
Kathy Thomasberg, Water Resources, formerly Water Resources, Monterey County. Interesting that this is all coming about right after my retirement. But the good thing is that I don't have to deal with diminished budgets. And I have three questions related to how this whole thing, the feasibility. First off, the funding for local and county agencies is pretty well. They haven't gotten back up yet for trying to even maintain a baseline for their programs, such as conservation, et cetera. And so now with these demands, because everybody is so protective of their funds, county supervisors versus water agencies, and I'm sure it's the same in Pajaro. And then if people are very protective of their funds, how are they going to want to work together? Now, you mentioned the funding availability at the state. However, I'm hearing, maybe I'm wrong, that is just for projects. So therefore, the rest of the funding, trying to get the wildcats working together, that is a huge feasibility issue for me.
I think that's a great question and a great point. One of the unique parts of Sigma is that it does provide direct fee authority to the local GSAs.
What does that mean to me, direct fee authority?
So those GSAs are allowed to assess fees for development of their plan, for implementation of their projects, and for management of the GSA itself. So they are allowed to directly levy a fee in some context, you know, that's up to the locals to decide how they want to do that, but they now have the authority to do so.
Okay.
And you know, there will be significant challenges to that, significantly Prop 218. You know, most likely there will be challenges along the lines of Prop 218, so I think in some context we'll just have to see how it plays out. The state funding, there's the $100 million from Prop 1, that's specifically allocated for development of sustainability plans and related projects. So, you know, DWR is still early in the stages of developing what those guidelines are going to be, but the thought is initially that will be going towards actually developing those sustainability plans with some related funding for projects associated with those plans. So if you need new monitoring wells, or if you need perhaps a new stream gauge to monitor surface water, groundwater interactions, something like that ties into the development of your plan, but is kind of a related project. Mm. Those other projects going forward, so the recycled water, the groundwater recharge, the stormwater capture, those are the places where I think there'll have to be a nexus between the state's funding availability, whether that's through Prop 1, whether it's through IREM, whether it's through existing revolving funds at the state board, and those locally generated fees developed by the GSAs.
Okay, second, actually, second and third question. It has to do with balancing basins, sustainability, and it occurred to me that many water systems now don't even have meters in the state of California. So therefore, how will we know how much water people are using unless it is a requirement by a higher entity to say everybody needs to install water meters and so maintain them?
That's another good question. And what SGMA requires is that the GSAs report as part of the development of their plans how much water is being pulled from the basin. There are actually a couple different ways that you can approach that question. One is to do metering, and there are examples throughout the state. Fox Canyon Groundwater Management Authority is one. The Mojave adjudication is another end example I'll talk about in a second, where they have required meters on every large extraction well. And then they use that to essentially come up with a water budget for the basin. You can also essentially do the same thing looking at land use. So if you know what crops are being grown, you make some assumptions about consumptive use. In fact, we've been talking with Cal Poly about ways that you can do this through remote sensing. You can essentially come up with an estimate of groundwater use if you know where your surface water sources are and how that surface water is being allocated. This is essentially a here's your surface water, here's total water use, you subtract it, here's how much groundwater you're reporting. If you do that method, it doesn't get you down to the parcel by parcel level necessarily, but in some cases that may not be necessary. That's really gonna be a locally driven question. And then the third way is through a true remote sensing approach where you actually use Landsat data and do some reflectance data, and this is what we've been talking with Cal Poly about, to actually come up with estimates of groundwater use. Again, you need to know surface water volumes, but there are other ways that you can do it.
Also, Fox Canyon's model was used by Monterey County Water Resources for extractions. They do it for 3,000 wells in the Salinas Valley.
Okay.
So I guess the next follow-up question is with the two alternatives that are not metering, are they sufficiently accurate to really give a good picture, sufficient picture for the needs?
They can be, and it's, again, gonna be, this is part of that regulation development that Water Resources is gonna have to do. There's gonna need to be some sort of review of the data that comes in. I think the department will get first assessment at that, but they're gonna need to look at whether or not the data that's submitted is accurate, realistic. You know, the same could also go for metering. If I have one metered well, in all of, let's just pick Paso Robles Basin, even though it's metered, it's not very realistic. So, you know, that's gonna have to be part of the process that's included in those sustainability plan regulations and development.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Thomas Burke. Mr. Johnston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's see, I have a couple of questions. First of all, just on what we were just talking about, correct me if I'm wrong, the local agencies, the bill gives the local agencies specific authority to order metering of wells, is that correct?
It does.
Okay. Correct me if I'm wrong, what I understood from what you said was if there is for example, a lower medium priority basin that gets changed to critical in 2017, that doesn't change their 2022 deadline for a sustainability plan because of the five-year number, is that correct?
So if it was a low or very low, then they wouldn't have to form a plan at all. They're redesignated as higher medium in 2017, then they would have 5 years or until 2022 to develop a sustainability plan and agency.
So what about a medium? Okay, so I'm trying to remember the high are required in 2020.
High and medium are 2022, but there's 18 critically overdrafted basins, and those are required in 2020.
So what I'm asking is, if a basin is upgraded from higher medium to critical in 2017, Is their deadline then for a sustainability plan 2020 or 2022?
That's a good question. It would be 2020. And so our understanding is that the department is working very quickly to come out with an updated list of critically overdrafted basins.
Okay,
in the next month or two.
You talked about the calculation involving population, population growth, irrigated acreage, public supply, well distribution, new criteria of impact on surface waters, and other variables. Is a level of overdraft one of the characteristics involved in the calculation of high, medium, et cetera?
Not necessarily. There is a category in that formula that says other factors as determined by the department. And so in some cases, they did use known overdraft to kind of elevate the level of that basin. But there's nothing specifically that refers to overdraft in that formula on its own.
Okay, that's curious. I'm looking at the backstop intervention, June 30th, 2017. Areas without a GSA begin reporting well locations and extraction data to the state board. Now, I'm trying to understand that. So are those only areas in medium, high, or critical?
Correct.
Okay. And then, so you talked about pumas and white spaces and reporting needs, and I was a little confused. I'm looking at the graphic that you put up for reporting system needs that covered much of the state with a sense of how many wells per
wells over 2 acre feet per year.
Wells over 2 acre feet per year, and then I'm looking at the graphic on the. Prioritization showed high, medium, low, very low. And I see huge areas, for example, in the Sierras, in our region, in the Coast Range, up in the North Coast on the prioritization map that don't have any coloring at all. So I assume those are just not mapped groundwater basins, is that correct?
Is it this map that you're referring to?
I am referring to that map, yes.
Okay.
So there's huge areas
yep.
in our region there in the Coast Range, but there's in the Sierras, and I was particularly looking up in the northern part of the state that have, I assume they just don't have mapped groundwater basins, is that correct?
Correct, so the sigma refers specifically to alluvial groundwater basins, and the Department of Water Resources has a definition for alluvial groundwater basins. This essentially means sediment, so sedimentary
okay.
fill. And if it hasn't been designated, then it's not marked as DWR by one of those alluvial basins.
Okay, so even though your map on reporting system needs, the slide you had up before this, shows a pretty fair number of wells in those areas of the Sierras, the Coast Range, the farther northern part of the state, you won't be collecting data from those wells if it's not in an alluvial groundwater basin, is that correct?
Even more so if it's not in a higher medium priority alluvial groundwater basin.
Okay, that's helpful. So when you're referring to white areas, those are areas that are in high or medium?
Correct, it would be somewhere in these red or yellow basins that don't form a GSA.
Okay. Got it. Just looking, I think those were the only questions that I had. That's it, thank you.
Thank you.
And next will be Mr. Delgado and then Ms. Cervantes.
All right, thank you, Jessica and Eric and Tom in the back for all the work you put into this. On the graph, figure you have up there on the screen, why wasn't overdraft one of those calculation variables considered?
So sigma used the CASGEM prioritization scheme. It kind of used that as a jumping off point. CASGEM was actually passed, I think in 2009 by SBX 7-1, although I'll get back to you on the specific number. It essentially required the Department of Water Resources to come up with a voluntary groundwater elevation monitoring program. It wasn't initially intended to be a tool to estimate overdraft or kind of endangerment of a groundwater resource. SGMA repurposed it and said, well, we're going to use this as our starting off point. And then that's why they added that other element that talks about, you know, ecosystems and other elements as the department factors in as necessary. So there is the opportunity for the department to kind of revise this prioritization scheme, but when it was originally developed, this wasn't the intended purpose. It was kind of a convenient tool that the state could use to kick things off.
So is it kind of like you don't want to use it as a hammer if it wasn't originally promised to be used as a hammer?
In part.
Okay. All right.
I will add that with you know the addition of that eighth element in this calculation, I think there is the intention that, yes, going forward, it can be used as a hammer. That maybe in the past it wasn't, they need to do some revisions to it, but we'll use this as the tool going forward.
All right, thank you. On the backstop state board intervention slide you had different deadlines, four different deadlines, and there'd be intervention triggers. And my question on that is, I assume that the state board has more staff and more funding resource capability than the regional boards, but you repeatedly mentioned how it's really important to be involving and engaging with the local at the local level as much as possible. So when these intervention triggers bring the state board intervention, is there any delegation of role to the regional water boards? And how will the local entities still be involved at that point?
That's a good question. I think we have some time to figure that out. I mean, realistically, by the time we start implementing the backstop, it's a minimum of 2.5 years, if not 4, 6, or 8 years in the future. At this point, we don't see direct delegation of authority to the regional boards, but clearly we do want to have regional board involvement. So I think it's going to depend partly on how many of these unmanaged areas we have, how many probationary basins we have. In terms of funding, you know, that's when we can use our fee authority to look at how to recoup costs and how to direct those funds as needed.
Is one of the options being discussed at this very early juncture having state representatives living and working on these trigger duties in the local areas or managing them from, let's say, Sacramento?
At this point, we've talked about managing them from Sacramento. We haven't really delved that deeply into that question, though.
Because it kind of reminds me of school districts where if they're taken over by the state, they have a state-assigned person to be the superintendent of that district until it's where it needs to be. That's why I was thinking about the parallel here. All right. The role as the basin manager, you talked about at some point there might be need to be interim plans drafted by the state. Well, I guess I wasn't sure. So my question is, who will draft those interim plans? Will it be DWR?
It will be the State Water Board. So the State Water Board is charged with the authority for developing those interim plans and implementing them.
Okay. So even though right now the seesaw is more loaded up on the responsibilities of DWR, once these intervention triggers kick in, then the State Water Board will have a larger lift.
Correct. And those lift. That lift will be significant. Those plans, you know, we figure will take a couple of years to develop. We have to put those plans through a CEQA analysis. It will be a significant workload.
Okay, thank you. My last question is on your coordination slide. You had in quotations that the board can't designate probationary basins without, quote, consulting with DWR, unquote. Does that mean that the State Water Board has the right after consultation to do what it wants as long as they consult? So there may be some disagreement, but if there is, the State Water Board trumps the DWR when it comes to probationary designations?
There is one place where the State Water Board trumps DWR, and there are two or three where DWR trumps State Water Board.
But that's kind of what that quote means?
Yes.
Okay.
In the present interpretation, you know, give us 5 or 7 years and our attorneys may tell us something differently.
And there could be amending legislation for these finer points as well, I
Correct.
Suppose. Right. Okay. Thank you both, and all three of you very much.
Ms. Cervantes?
Yes, my question just had to do a bit more with the evaluation of how well these plans are being implemented. I do think that a regional approach and coordination oftentimes allows us the opportunity to take stock, if you will, of where we are in terms of our sustainability efforts. But the other piece of it, too, I imagine, is that a lot of different agencies have a long list of needs, whether they be infrastructure needs. We talked a lot about improving also water quality. So I'm wondering, maybe I'm getting a little too micro right now in terms of the criteria in the plan, but is part of the evaluation of how well this is going to be implemented or potentially might be implemented going to be identifying funding sources for what people or agencies, regions have identified as greater needs? And funding resources, of course, we've all talked about this, are limited. So in that situation, sort of what flexibility is available so that there isn't necessarily state intervention at the local level if people have identified a great plan, they just have not been able to locate the resources to fully implement some of the improvements necessary.
I think that I'll address the last point first. And again, it's very early to really say, but I think the point of SGMA is that they do have to address that financial solvency. So, you know, if they develop a great plan but they can't get it implemented, then that would open the door to state board intervention. The locals have to adopt the responsibility of whether it's through a Prop 218 fee assessment, working with the county, some other funding mechanism to develop their own plans and resources. Now, this is something that we've also talked about, what the state board intervention will look like. And I didn't put it up on a slide here, but you know, if you develop it at the local level, you have a lot of opportunities. We call them physical solutions. So desal plants, recycled water, all those things that we mentioned earlier, the state board doesn't have that capacity. And so if the state board does have to come in and directly manage a groundwater basin, what we're most likely going to be looking at is supply reduction. So we'll be tamping down groundwater use. And we don't have the capacity to go in and develop and fund a recycled water plant for a local community or a local GSA. So that was your first question. Can you repeat the last part? Can you repeat the first part?
No, I think that you've answered it, because I was trying to understand what some of the evaluation would be in figuring out whether a region is not properly implementing their plan.
Okay. And, you know, I do want to add something there that, you know, it's very early in the process, but the Department of Water Resources, that would be something that they include in their sustainability plan regulations.
So in pending legislation, what about the water funding issues? I mean, Prop 218, sort of getting clarity on some of the ways in which fees can be assessed.
I don't know of any state efforts at this point, although there have been a couple of articles that have talked about the different financing mechanisms that could be available. And I'll see if I can find those and forward them on to you. I don't have a good grasp of them at the time.
Thank you.
Dr. Hunter?
Thank you. Thank you both. Very informative. So looking at the slide on undesirable results, one of those you identified was seawater intrusion. And so I have a question about how does SGMA define or require that seawater intrusion be addressed as a factor where seawater intrusion is already occurring? And then I understand that we're talking about 2022 before any intervention really can occur. So in coastal basins that are in overdraft, it seems likely to me that we're going to see increasing levels of seawater intrusion where the groundwater basin is susceptible.
Mm-hmm.
And so as the water table lowers through ongoing drought.
Mm-hmm.
So what can you tell us about how that factors in, and is there technical assistance? Are there dollars available for creating, and that, I guess, gets into the groundwater sustainability plan, for creating systems that would create barriers and those kinds of remedies?
So I'll start with the easy one first.
Okay.
There will be some sort of funding opportunities. And that goes, again, back to the Prop 100 million. There's also the additional board funding. There's DWRI or WM funding. So you're working coordinated with your, whether it's your IRM group or your county or whoever is kind of the lead funding agency, there could be opportunities. It's still very early yet. You know, Sigma is only 5 months old at this point. And so we're still learning and kind of figuring out how some of this is going to work. In terms of how Sigma treats seawater intrusion, what the law says is basically if there is seawater intrusion in your basin, that your sustainability plan has to address that issue. What it doesn't do is define what significant and unreasonable is. And so there's the question of when you factor in the kind of ambiguity about what significant and unreasonable is with a baseline condition of already having some amount of seawater intrusion and the concept that, you know, they don't have to stop seawater intrusion necessarily. The time frame for implementation is 20 years. So when you start a plan, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're instantly going to be sustainable. The concept was that you phase it in over what could be a long time period. At the same time, in some of these small coastal basins, you don't have 20 years necessarily to allow the same rate of seawater intrusion. And so it's in those circumstances where I think the Department of Water Resources will need to look at that initial review, think about what significant and unreasonable means, rather than providing maybe a prescriptive definition, maybe leaving it more open-ended so there's some flexibility, and really working with locals to figure out what needs to be done. At the same time, on top of that, you know, there still is board authority, that Section 2100 adjudication authority was specifically developed, or not specifically developed, but specifically applies to seawater intrusion. It has been used in Fox Canyon. There was talk once upon a time of using it in Monterey and Salinas, and in both cases, local efforts kind of got together and dealt with the issue. Los Osos is the most primary example right now, and it appears that the local efforts are trying to deal with the issue. The question is, what are they doing, and how long of a time frame do they have? And you know, that remains to be seen.
So that brings me to kind of a follow-up. So with the adjudication that's going on, it's been a 10-year process, and I think that there may have been some incentives for that process to come to a close, which is very good news, given the state situation with water and all the new legislation and new deadlines in the OFIC. So is there a mechanism then for, or will DWR look at existing adjudicated basins where seawater intrusion is a feature? Will they be able to step in and look at that, or do those plans just sit in a locked box and nobody gets to look at them, or nobody gets to figure out when they went into adjudication, were they factoring in the current stresses that are occurring in basins and elevation dropping and seawater intrusion increasing? I'm really puzzled by the fact that these are being grandfathered in and they may not actually be sustainable plans at all.
That's a great question. And I think right now there's actually a bit of a lack of knowledge on that issue. What Sigma does require is, you know, it exempts them from developing a GSA and a plan. They still have to report some key information to the department. The presumption is that that information will be made public. So that includes how much water is being pumped out and a copy of their management plan and I think other relevant data. So there will be some daylighting, I think, of what's going on in adjudications. But the question, or the comment as to whether those adjudications are actually sustainable is a very good one. I don't think we really know in a lot of cases.
So in other words, there is some flex in there because we're still in the early stages of defining what the regulations, how the regulations will address these particular
In some context, but it, you know, I do want to reiterate that those adjudications are specifically exempt from Sigma.
Right.
So, you know, if it turned out that there was some sort of huge overdraft issue, I think, you know, really we'd point back to the adjudication first, but Sigma couldn't address it.
Okay, no, let me ask it differently then, because I want to be sure I'm clear. So the data that they're required to submit, if before 2022, DWR begins to see that some of these adjudicated basins are really not operating according to a sustainable management plan, given the changes that have occurred relative to the drought. If they're addressing the drought, great. If they're being proactive, great. That would probably show up in their data. Conservation plans and other things that they're implementing. So that would be the only avenue, if you will, for anything to trigger.
And that wouldn't trigger necessarily anything through Sigma or through the board or through the department. There's nothing in Sigma that would actually give us the intervention authority in any way to deal with those adjudications. It'd really have to go back, I think, to the adjudication or through some sort of public need or outcry, essentially, to deal with it. But it wouldn't grant the board or DWR authority.
You're talking about a community that's in public outcry for 20 years in Los Altos. So. Okay, thanks.
So thank you. I do have one speaker card from Mr. Jeff Edwards, and then Mr. Harris has some parting comments. I think while you come to the podium, you know, the way I interpret all this is that the new water book called Sigma just went out for press, and the introduction page has been written, the chapters, sections have been written, but the content has to still be filled out. So I think there's a lot of speculation in, you know, a lot. It's going to be a...
The devil's in the details.
Yes, I mean, exactly.
It's going to be a devil
so
to figure them out.
Thank you very much. So before you start, Mr. Edward, you know, you need to fill out your address. So I'm going to give you two options. It's a requirement. Either you state your address on the mic, or if you prefer, I will have you fill out your address, and I'll give you the card back when you're done, and then you give it to our clerk of the board, but that's a requirement for every testimony card, okay?
Dr. Yes. Wolf, actually, it's up to Mr. Edwards whether he wants to provide that information or not.
Why don't we have on our testimony cards then the word optional?
We should.
Okay, so as an action step, please make sure that we revise the testimony cards and put a little box optional. Thank you. Go ahead.
Housekeeping accomplished?
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Want to keep things straight.
Thank you, Chairman Wolf. Good morning, while it still is morning, board members. My name is Jeff Edwards. I'm a 40-year resident of Los Osos. Initially, I'd like to thank Mr. Ekdahl and his staff for a very instructive presentation. Principally about sustainability plans and the Groundwater Sustainability Management Act. In Los Osos, as you know, we're a little bit ahead of the game, if you will bear with that expression. We do have a basin management plan. The Superior Court of San Luis Obispo County is scheduled to consider the approval of that document in August of this year. But as was alluded to, implementation is the difficult part and truly is the key. I'd like to visit with you a little bit about Los Osos and our options and our strategies. Clearly, conservation is number one. In the urban area, we've reduced our use by from over 2,000 acre feet per year to just over 1,300 acre feet per year, so almost in half. Additionally, the basin plan under Program C calls for additional wells, extraction wells, on the east part of town, moving away from those wells that are located nearest the shoreline and principally inducing the seawater intrusion wedge. So conservation, a new east side well or wells. And then the third part of this three-legged stool, if you will, is a surface water discharge. And this is an item that we'll be coming back to your board to consider, hopefully in the near term. And this would be a seasonal release of treated effluent in the upper reaches of Los Osos Creek. Our groundwater basin, the geology of which is, we have our lower Paso Robles formation sweeps up and daylights at the creek bottom at this location, at the upper reaches of the creek. So we think that this will be a great opportunity to manage our groundwater basin and recharge it on a seasonal basis in the summer when the creek is dry. Los Osos Creek dries up virtually every year. Right now, there's an RFP that is due tomorrow to conduct a feasibility study of this surface seasonal surface water discharge in the creek. I think it's going to be a critical component of our basin management. I'd also like to state that the Los Osos groundwater basin, it's not so much a safe yield or overdraft situation. It's about management. And we're fortunate in that regard that we do have groundwater flows that can cover our uses, both domestic, urban, and agriculture. But it's this management. And so the items that I mentioned hopefully will be implemented, and that's the key, particularly with regard to the NPDES permit your board may consider in the future. I'd like to close with a couple observations that the goal in Los Osos, I believe a feasible and realistic goal is to slow or stop the seawater intrusion wedge. I've heard about the notion of reversing this, and I have to say that I don't believe that's realistic. I think this is something we need to take up with the Coastal Commission, because their
You need to wrap up your comment, please.
I will, thank you very much. The Coastal Commission's view is that we need to reverse the wedge, and I just don't think that's practical. Finally, I just want to note, and by way of clarification, that insofar as irrigated agriculture is concerned in our valley, they are not participating and won't for the foreseeable future participate in taking recycled water. Unlike Monterey, the Monterey Peninsula, our agricultural interests, our irrigated ag folks have lots of water and it's very high quality, so there's virtually no motivation for them to take any of that water. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Harris?
I just have one question for Eric, and the reason is I know that you all sitting up there oftentimes ask me questions about, you know, what the regional board staff are doing and what, you know, what our role and responsibility is, and we've sort of touched on that with a couple of questions from the board members, but I wanted to ask Eric, in the next couple of years, is there any role for regional boards to work on this issue, or is it the state board's view that this really is under the state's purview and the regional board should do our other activities and leave this up to you, or do you think the state board is going to look at that and try to carve out a role for the regional boards? And it's not just this board that asks questions, but we also have a lot of local entities who come to us. We're always the first, it seems like the first place that people turn, because we're accessible and we're local, and a lot of times Sacramento can be a very confusing place for the novice. So I wonder if you could address that, please.
Sure. It's a great question, and I think it really remains to be seen what happens in the future. As you point out, you know, the regional board served this great role as being almost the first line of public response. So you're the place where people stop first. You're the place where people ask questions. And at the state board, we need to figure out how we can use that to our advantage in implementing SGMA. Right now, we don't have any formal role designated for the regional boards, but clearly we want to involve them and kind of use the knowledge and the resources that you do have available as we start the backstop process. So, that's a long-winded way of saying probably we'll see in the future.
Any other input, Mr. Harris?
No, thank you for the clarification.
All right. Well, I thank you very much for both of you for a comprehensive presentation, and I guess we'll stay tuned. Mm-hmm.